This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host Red Zell, and this week we'll be getting intimate with some great love stories. Francesca Siegel discusses the family tensions that lovers can ignite.
It's the modern family, really. It's sort of trying to make a family with teenage stepchildren, trying to make a relationship when you have responsibilities elsewhere.
Sarah Mallory lifts the veil on her Mills and Boone success.
For Mills and Boone, it's something that people often say that Mills and Boone must have a formula. They have a formula for success, and that's choosing the right books, obviously.
Robert discovers love in many forms on the library shelves, and I find A Wartime Affair a bit too up close and personal. That's all coming up in today's show. Author Francesca Siegel is one to watch. Her debut, The Innocents, won a clutch of prizes, including the Costa Award for a first novel. It tells the story of Adam and Rachel, childhood sweethearts preparing to marry and settle down into Northwest London community that raised them. But their perfect plans are thrown into disarray when Rachel's reckless cousin Ellie returns from New York in scandalous circumstances. It's funny, poignant and brilliantly observed, with echoes of Jane Austen and Nick Hornby. Her second novel, The Awkward Age, is published today, and she came hotfoot from the launch party to the studio to talk about it, The Innocents, and writing the modern love story. Francesca, welcome to Read On Air.
Hi, thank you. I'm so excited to be here. It's a real pleasure.
Just before we came in, we were talking about the new novel, The Awkward Age, which is out in May. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. I was just saying to you, this is my first interview I've done for this book, so I haven't sort of perfected my elevator pitch. But yes, it is a big, messy North London family novel, I suppose. It's set at a later stage in life than my first novel. So Julia is the mother of a teenage daughter, Gwen, and lost her husband 5 years ago, but has now found love and potential happiness with James, who has moved in with his teenage children. And it's really the story of how to make two halves of families into a whole. It's the modern family, really. It's sort of trying to make a family with teenage stepchildren, trying to make a relationship when you have responsibilities elsewhere.
The Innocents was very much about first love and a couple who were almost destined to get married. But this is very much rediscovering love then, is it?
If anything, this is very much second love. James is divorced, Julia is widowed, and they found one another probably against the odds, I think it's fair to say. So it's about second chances, really, and about the conflict, really, between personhood and parenthood. Julia's very much trying to find a way to follow her heart, very much against the wishes of her teenage daughter.
Oh, so it deals with the love that you choose and the love that is, well, I suppose almost duty as far as family is concerned.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. It's the tension between romantic, passionate love and the very, very deep responsibility and love that one feels for one's children, which I suppose is, you know, one is often torn between one's spouse and one's children at various points, but that is exacerbated when the spouse or the partner in question isn't a co-parent.
In The Innocents, there was an examination of the love that is expected by the community that Adam and Rachel have grown up in. This reflects a different kind of tension. The children might be pulling you in an opposite direction to the way that your heart would like to go.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's Gwen is 15. She's been an only child raised by a single parent for 5 years. They have been very, very intensely dependent and necessarily dependent and close to one another. And all of a sudden, their unit is disrupted by sort of almost a betrayal of her mother by finding love elsewhere. And Gwen is still young enough to feel outraged at the thought of her mother as an independent person with needs beyond those that Gwen can fulfill. And I think probably feels quite betrayed because she has been offering up her needs in a way as a way to occupy her mother and see her through the grief at losing her first husband. And and all of a sudden, Julia is happy and happy about something that isn't drawn from the two of them. It's negotiating, I think, that very real dilemma that many people feel in second relationships, trying to, as a second couple, you cannot put yourselves first, but you also mustn't put yourselves last.
Absolutely. And again, I suppose that's the same kind of tension that comes through in The Innocents as well, where there are close communities, whether it's the whole Jewish community in Golders Green, or I suppose that the community of the mother and the daughter, those communities are both supportive and stifling.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Negotiating what the sort of beautiful and supportive and nurturing aspects of those communities or family or the kind of wider circle with the pressure and the expectation and the kind of claustrophobia of those expectations also.
And I know that for The Innocents, you said that you were inspired for the initial scene by reading Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence, but I also felt there was a real sense of sort of Jane Austen type of close community and actually having to face the fact that there are realities outside that community. And it provides a great scope for humour and also for pathos.
Oh, God, any sentence that has my name and Jane Austen's in it is a sentence that I will treasure, so thank you. Yeah, I hope it's funny. It was certainly, I find humour and pathos in those tensions, I think. Exploring the absurd is one of the pleasures of, or rather, the absurd is one of the pleasures of those communities, I think, or any community. Living cheek by jowl with any group of people is going to be nurturing and supportive and stifling and probably ridiculous at many points.
And you're clearly a very keen observer. I mean, I love the warts and all portrayal of the whole community, but it's done with a very fond smile, I felt.
I hope so. That was how I intended it. It's, you know, I wanted to write, I suppose, a comedy of manners. And so for that, you are writing, as you say, warts and all. And I don't think there's anything to be embarrassed about writing an honest portrait of a community, particularly because I think, you know, in this instance, it was Jewish North London, but you could very easily substitute in almost any close religious or ethnic or almost any other community, I think, would substitute in quite well, and the tensions and the roles and the dramas would all be the same.
Well, as somebody who grew up in a small village in the Sussex countryside, I can tell you it felt very, very familiar, if with a slightly different reading of the Bible, I suppose.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, well, there you go.
I hope you're not sick of people mentioning it, but you're obviously Eric Siegel's daughter, Eric, who wrote both the screenplay and the novel of Love Story. Did you always know that you were going to be an author? Did it feel like that was being passed down along with your sort of cultural heritage?
I don't remember ever wanting to do anything else. I can't think of a time when I didn't know that this was what I wanted to try and be. I suppose that's the way to put it. I never knew whether I could. One can never depend on finding a publisher or being privileged enough to do it as a career, but it was all I ever wanted. And all I ever really imagined doing was writing stories. It seems to me, I don't know why everyone doesn't think it's the best job in the world.
What is it? Hard work, but very, very satisfying when it happens.
Yeah.
Did you show your father your work as you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. I booted him off his typewriter in order to compose quite a great deal of it. So he was forced to read a lot of it. Yeah, no, I did just naturally sort of hand him things. And I mean, my imaginary friend when I was very little was my secretary who took my dictation.
Oh.
So I think, I don't know if it's slightly slightly precocious, but it was just what he did was what I wanted to do, basically.
And you went on to become the reviewer for debut novels for The Observer. Do you think that taught you as much about writing as maybe your father and your reading habits did?
I think it was hugely instructive, and I would urge anybody who aspires to write to just look. I don't know where else one is forced to confront a book mountain like that that shows you just how many debut novels are published in a year. Because there was a period when I was writing that column where most, if not all, debut novels were sent to me over the course of a year. And obviously I wasn't able to read all of them, but I certainly read the first page or the first chapter of all of them. And I would sit, you know, these Santa Claus sacks would arrive, and it was just the weight of them made me very aware that the world didn't need another debut novel, and I had better wait until I really had something to say if I was going to attempt it, certainly if I was going to attempt to publish something. And the other sobering lesson, I suppose, along the same lines was that there were so very, very many debut novels, and, you know, it's now been almost a, you know, more than a decade since I started writing that column, and so few of those names have recurred with a, you know, a second book. I've seen so few second novels from those. Not none, but it was sobering to be reminded that actually it's a very, very hard industry, and probably never harder than now.
This week's theme for the programme is love stories, and I think you wrote a very successful, quirky view on love, the love story in The Innocents, which definitely made me smile and laugh throughout. What do you think the essential ingredients for a good love story are?
I think probably the essential ingredients for a good modern love story are honesty above all and humour, I think. I think there's a lot of very earnest writing about love, and which can be beautiful and moving, but real life is messy and ridiculous and complicated, and I think maybe those are the things that make something. Recognising that truth might be one of the ingredients that makes love stories moving.
Yeah, showing that the ideal image is a little bit more messy underneath the surface.
Absolutely, and that's okay.
Well, that's actually normal.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
We were talking before we came into the studio about the audiobook versions of The Innocents, and you were telling me that you've been giving pronunciation instructions to the narrator of The Awkward Age.
Yeah, my husband walked in the other night, and I was just reciting a strange list of foreign words onto someone's voicemail in California. But she sent me an email, the producer sent me an email saying, you know, there's a lot of Yiddish in your book, and we just wanted to check the pronunciation. And also there in America, they're doing this recording, even though the narrator is British. So she wanted to check things like arse. She was very worried about arse. Was it ass or arse? And I suppose I don't realise how much Yiddish I use, although this is a much less Jewish book. But machatonim, which is an amazing Yiddish word for which there is no English translation, which means your child's spouse's parents. That's what they are to you. So the other set of in-laws, basically, are the machatonim. So I was sort of pronouncing all these words onto the producer's voicemail in California, and my husband walked in and said, "Who are you talking to, and what are you talking about?"
And this was 2 o'clock in the morning or something.
Yes, it was. It was
unbelievable.
But yeah, I'm very, very excited about the recording. I absolutely love audiobooks. I think there are certain books that are just lend themselves so beautifully. It's a better way of reading, even if one has all options available.
Do you always have an audiobook on the go?
Always, absolutely always. I get this amazing synesthesia where if I have reached a really climactic moment in a book, in, you know, the vegetable aisle of the supermarket, it will always forever be where that event took place, and they kind of meld together in this really wonderful sort of... Yeah, no, I wouldn't be without one.
Oh, fantastic. So there are corners of Waitrose where where people have fallen in love or split up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a corner shop in New York that was where around the corner from where I used to live, which was where, I don't know if you've read Midnight's Children, but Salim Sanai is held up by the nose by his teacher. And it happened for me in that corner shop. And every time I go there, my blood pressure raises because it's such a high-stakes, sort of ludicrous, terrible scene. But I love that it sort of is like almost overlaid over one's life.
What are you listening to at the moment then?
At the moment I am re-listening to Anna Karenina, and it's actually the LibriVox version.
Oh, right.
I think LibriVox is so brilliant, and all my friends in America seem to know about it, and people here just seem not to have heard of it. I don't know whether that's just the circles that I move in, but I'm absolutely evangelical about LibriVox.
I love the fact that the books are read by volunteers. So, and you can have alternating chapters, you know, somebody in the outback in Australia reading a chapter of Jane Eyre, and then you get somebody from Hong Kong reading the next chapter. It's fantastic.
Yeah, they are brilliant. I have to say, I do sometimes lose my patience with the switching. I've now got narrators that I'm obsessive about following. So Elizabeth Klett, I think, is amazing. And Mill Nicholson, who's on LibriVox and has done, I think I'm right in saying, almost all of Dickens. And she's just fabulous. And there's no changing of voices. And so those two are my absolute favourites. Anything they record, I will listen to.
I think that's something that would chime very much with our listeners who have their favourite narrators for the Talking Books Library.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who will go and search out the next David Thorpe reading, which is fantastic. So, Francesca Segal, thank you so much for coming in, telling us about The Awkward Age, which I can't wait to listen to when it comes out.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real treat.
Thanks to Francesca Segal. The Awkward Age is out today, published simultaneously in audiobook and hardback. The Innocents is available from the RNIB Library as TB20539, and we'll be hearing more from Francesca later in the show.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
As the old song says, love is a many splendid thing, and it fills our hearts and minds in a variety of different ways, all of which have inspired authors to put pen to paper. Robert Kirkwood has been exploring the RNIB Library to bring us this selection of great and varied love stories.
Love isn't all about roses. It can take many forms, from the first flush of romance to the everyday love we feel for our family and friends. Sometimes we mistake obsession for love, or let good love go bad. In honour of this season, here are some of our favourite books about love in all its shapes and sizes, all available to borrow from RNIB libraries. Unless otherwise stated, all books are available from RNIB Overdrive, Talking Books on Daisy CD or USB stick, and in giant print and in Braille, which will be contracted grade 2. First up, under Love and Romance, I Capture the Castle.
I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left.
Read by Candida Gubbins, I Capture the Castle is a coming-of-age story told through the eyes of 17-year-old Cassandra. She and her family are living in increasing poverty as her novelist father struggles with writer's block. But the arrival of a wealthy American family and two unmarried brothers brings hope to Cassandra and her sister.
How odd it is to remember that tea once meant afternoon tea to us, little cakes and thin bread and butter in the drawing room. Now it is as solid a meal as we can scrape together as it has to last us until breakfast. We have it after Thomas gets back from school. Stephen is lighting the lamp. In a second now, the rosy glow will have gone from the kitchen. But lamplight is beautiful too.
I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith is talking book number 13308. And staying under the heading of Love and Romance, Me Before You. Louisa is hired to care for Will, a quadriplegic who's given up on life. The story should be cliched, but in Me Before You, which is read by Lucy Scott, Jojo Moyes has written a realistic and intelligent novel with a healthy dose of comic relief.
I am not thick. I'd just like to get that out of the way at this point. But it's quite hard not to feel a bit deficient in the department of brain cells, growing up next to a younger sister who has not just moved up a year into my class, but then to the year above. Everything that is sensible or smart, Katrina did first, despite being 18 months younger than me. Every book I ever read, she had read first. Every fact I mentioned at the dinner table, she already knew. She's the only person I know who actually likes exams. Sometimes I think I dress the way I do because the one thing Trina can't do is put clothes together. She's a pullover and jeans kind of a girl. Her idea of smart is ironing the jeans first.
Me Before You is talking book number 19527. Also under Love and Romance, Oscar and Lucinda. Peter Carey's Man Booker Prize-winning novel, read by Nigel Graham, is an unusual love story. Oscar, a Cornish priest, bets Lucinda, an Australian heiress, that he can build her a glass church in the Australian outback, a gamble which will change both their lives.
This was in Devon, near Torquay. To pretend, as Theophilus did, that this was almost tropical is like referring to a certain part of Melbourne as the Paris end of Collins Street. It's quite reasonable if you've never been to Paris, but once you've been there, you can see the description as nothing more than wishful thinking. When I visit Devon, I see nothing tropical. I'm surprised, rather, that so small a county can contain so vast and indifferent a sky. Devon seems cruel and cold. I look at the queer arrangements of rocks up on the moor and think of ignorance and poverty and cold, always the cold.
Oscar and Lucinda by Peter Carey, read there by Nigel Graham, is talking book number 7283. Also, Love in the Time of Cholera. In Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel, Love in the Time of Cholera, which is read by Jonathan Oliver, Florentino and Fermina fall in love in their youth, but Fermina's father persuades her to marry someone else. Undeterred, Florentino waits for his love to return to him as the years and decades pass.
Florentino Ariza, on the other hand, had not stopped thinking of her for a single moment since Fermina Daza had rejected him out of hand after a long and troubled love affair 51 years, 9 months, and 4 days ago. He did not have to keep a running tally, drawing a line for each day on the walls of a cell, because not a day had passed that something did not happen to remind him of her. At the time of their separation, he lived with his mother, Transito Ariza, in one half of a rented house on the Street of Windows, where she had kept a notions shop ever since she was a young woman, and where she also unravelled shirts and old rags to sell as bandages for the men wounded in the war. He was her only child, born of an occasional alliance with the well-known shipowner Don Pius V Loaiza, one of the three brothers who had founded the River Company of the Caribbean and thereby given new impetus to steam navigation along the Magdalena River. Don Pius V Loaiza died when his son was 10 years old. Although he always took care of his expenses in secret, he never recognized him as his son before the law, nor did he leave him with his future secure. So that Florentino Ariza used only his mother's name, even though his true parentage was always common knowledge.
Love in the Time of Cholera is talking book number 13505. The next few books about love are under the heading of family ties. And next up is Gilead. In Gilead by Marlon Robinson, read by Kim Jerome, the elderly and dying Reverend John Ames records his life and the experiences of his father and grandfather before him to share with his 7-year-old son. Never sentimental, the novel is a poignant reflection on life and what we leave behind, and how our families shape us.
I saw a bubble float past my window, fat and wobbly and ripening toward that dragonfly blue they turn just before they burst. I looked down at the yard, and there you were, you and your mother, blowing bubbles at the cat. Such a barrage of them that the poor beast was beside herself at the glut of opportunity. She was actually leaping in the air, our insouciant Soapy. Some of the bubbles drifted up through the branches, even above the trees. You two were too intent on the cat to see the celestial consequences of your worldly endeavors. They were very lovely. Your mother is wearing her blue dress, and you are wearing your red shirt, and you are kneeling on the ground together with Soapy between you, and that effulgence of bubbles rising, and so much laughter. Ah, this life, this world.
Gilead by Marilyn Robinson is talking book number 17484. Also under the heading of Family Ties, behind the scenes at the museum.
I am conceived to the chimes of midnight on the clock on the mantelpiece in the room across the hall. The clock once belonged to my great-grandmother, a woman called Alice, and its tired chime counts me into the world.
Read by Susan Jameson, behind the scenes at the museum was Kate Atkinson's first novel and promised all the great things that we now expect of her today. In this hilarious and sometimes heartbreaking family saga, the central character, Ruby Lennox, chronicles the lives of the four generations of women in her family, leading to her own.
Frank spent most of the rest of his leave with one or other of the girls. He took Nellie to the music hall at the Empire, and Lillian took him to a meeting at the educational settlement, but it was a bit above his head. They were all Quakers and conches and socialists, and they kept on about negotiating an end to the war. Frank thought they were a load of slackers and was glad he was in uniform. "Do you think you should be mixing with folk like these?" he said to Lillian as he walked her home, and she just looked at him and said, "Frank," and laughed. More enjoyable was when all three of them went to see Jane Shaw at the new picture house in Coney Street, which had just opened and was really grand with its 1,000 tip-up seats. When he had to go back to the front, he felt worse than he had done leaving the first time, and he could hardly bear to leave Nell and Lillian behind.
Behind the Scenes at the Museum is not available in giant print, but it's talking book number 13467. Also under the heading of Family Ties, Wise Children. Angela Carter's book, read by Gretel Davis, is a body romp worth of Shakespeare taking us on a wild ride through the tangled fortunes of two families, the hazards and the chances. From the point of view of 75-year-old dancing twins, Dora and Nora Chance.
Welcome to the land of make-believe, to where the moon shone on Charlie Chaplin every moonlight night. Welcome to dreamland. We'd only ever seen a palm tree before at Bournemouth. It came as a shock. So big, so hairy. And the sunshine, like a benediction, said Irish. He was so pleased I'd got it up for him that even the weather seemed intentional. But I wouldn't move in with him, not on your life. I got too much residual sense for that, although I must say I was very struck. Struck with his faded but still potent charm, his vulnerability under his surface assurance, his soft, light baritone with its gracious East Coast modulations, his wasted talent, of which even the morbid scripts he now churned out at so many dollars the yard retained some wizened gleam. But he did wonders for my grammar, not to mention my grasp of metaphor, as witness the style of this memoir.
It's available in all formats except giant print, and it's talking book number 9107. That's Angela Carter's Wise Children. Finally, at our look at some alternative books about love, let's look at Passion, Betrayal and Obsession, starting with The Good Soldier. A tale of dissolving marriages, death and madness. The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, read by Peter Wickham and Thomas C. Moser, is narrated by the character John Dowell, who relates the story of two marriages, his own and that of his two close friends. But all is not as it seems, and very soon a tangled web of illicit affairs and betrayal is revealed.
Lady Elizabeth had been instructed by Sir Harry to warn her daughter not to fall in love with Cousin George during his visit to Humblethwaite. And Lady Elizabeth was, as a wife, accustomed to obey her husband in all things. But obedience in this matter was very difficult. Such a caution as that received is not easily given even between a mother and a child, and is especially difficult when the mother is unconsciously aware of her child's superiority to herself. Emily was in all respects the bigger woman of the two, and was sure to get the best of it in any such cautioning. It is so hard to have to bid a girl, and a good girl too, not to fall in love with a particular man.
The Good Soldier is available in Braille from RNIB Overdrive and as a talking book on CD or USB stick, talking book number 16485. And staying under the heading of passion, betrayal and obsession, Atonement. Ian McEwan's book, read by Carol Boyd, is a family saga which begins in 1935 and continues through the Second World War and on to the present day. It follows the devastating consequences of a young girl's mistake, in particular for the young lovers whose lives are ripped apart in the wake of their actions.
Bryony sat on the floor with her back to one of the tall built-in toy cupboards and fanned her face with the pages of her play. The silence in the house was complete. No voices or footfalls downstairs, no murmurs from the plumbing. In the space between one of the open sash windows, a trapped fly had abandoned its struggle, and outside, the liquid birdsong had evaporated in the heat. She pushed her knees out straight before her and let the folds of her white muslin dress and the familiar, endearing pucker of skin about her knees fill her view. She should have changed her dress this morning. She thought how she should take more care of her appearance, like Lola. It was childish not to, but what an effort it was.
Atonement by Ian McEwan is talking book number 13411. And finally, The Collector. In The Collector by John Foles, read by William Abney, a lonely young butterfly collector kidnaps an art student and keeps her captive in his cellar. Told from both points of view, this dark, tense novel charts the emotions of each character as the confinement continues.
Just before I shut the door, she said, "You've forgotten your lighter." "I've got another." I hadn't. "Thank you," she said. It was funny, she almost smiled. I made the Nescafe and I took it into her and she watched me drink some and then she drank some. All the time she asked questions. No, all the time I felt she might ask a question, she'd come out quickly with a question to try and catch me. About how long she had to stay, why I was being so kind to her. I made up answers, but I knew they sounded feeble. It wasn't easy to invent quickly with her.
The Collector, the last in this list of alternative books about love, is talking book number 4532. For more information on how to get any of the books mentioned in that list, head to www.rnib.org.uk or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. All books mentioned are available on RNIB Overdrive to download directly to your computer or smart device. They're available on Daisy CD or Daisy USB stick. They're also available in Braille and most are available in giant print.
Thanks to Robert for that all-embracing guide to books about love. Do you have a favourite love story? We'd love to hear about it. Why not drop us a line via email? The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB News Agent Service, which delivers the latest news, magazines and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB newsagent service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic, and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
For decades, one of the most popular forms of love story has been the Mills and Boone novel, and one of its most successful authors is Sarah Mallory. She came into the studio to hear one of her titles being recorded as a talking book, and Robert Kirkwood caught up with her.
The book that we're talking about, this Entering the mm-hmm. Talking Books Library, is yep. Beneath the Major's Scars.
That's right.
Now, after being shamelessly seduced by a married man now, can you help me pronounce his name? Is it Zela?
Zela.
Well, she yes. finds her reputation in tatters. Determined to rise above the gossip mongers, Zela knows she can rely on no one but herself. Now, what can we expect from Beneath the Major's Scars?
It's a Beauty and the Beast type of love story. A damaged hero. He's a war hero from the a soldier from the Napoleonic Wars, who shut himself away on Exmoor. And the heroine, obviously, she has problems to overcome of her own. So you have two people who have to find some confidence and find themselves, and also help each other along the way. And also, there's I like to put adventure in my books. I don't just like a romance. I like it to be sort of like a romantic historical adventure.
Yeah, because you tend to write in the Georgian and the Regency periods.
Yes, I do. It's my favourite periods. I've been studying and reading about Georgian and Regency since I was at school. Although I like other periods of history as well, but that is my favourite period.
Now, is there a formula for writing a romance novel?
For Mills and Boone, it's something that people often say that Mills and Boone must have a formula. They have a formula for success, and that's choosing the right books, obviously. The happy ending, you have to have, for the Mills and Boone type romances, it tends to be a man and a woman, and you have to have a happy ending. How they get there is up to you. With romances, it tends to be that the hero and heroine have to be around and not exactly together, but in the reader's mind for most of the time. So they have to spend an awful lot of time on stage, as it were. But there is no real formula. I was writing historical romantic adventures as Melinda Hammond before I started writing for Mills and Boone. And they're very similar. They all have a action. I grew up on the old action movies, the Hollywood action movies, whether it was Cowboys and Indians or The Crimson Pirate. So I tend to like those sort of adventure books with a handsome hero and a brave heroine. I just like to carry on with that sort of premise in my books.
Now, you're in the RNIB's Talking Book Studios at the moment, and I believe the fact that Beneath the Major Scars is becoming a talking book is a wee bit more important to you than maybe some other authors.
It was. When I heard that it was going to be turned into a talking book, I was just so thrilled because I have twin sons, and they were diagnosed with keratoconus when they were, very young, about 10, 11, I believe. It's such a long time ago now. One of them, it's not too serious, but the other one's had to have a cornea graft on one eye. And he has, I must say, he has very, very good vision now with the help of contact lenses and the corneal transplant. But obviously we had to face the fact that he could be, there was a possibility that he would be blind. And it's quite an emotive thing. And I was to know that one of my books is going to the RNIB is fabulous. I was just so thrilled.
Keratoconus is one of these conditions that we don't hear much about, but it's far more common than you'd think, with as many people as 1 in 500 having it, but unfortunately not diagnosed.
Well, it was only because my sons were we have a very good optician locally, I used to take them along because I'm short-sighted anyway. I was having regular eye checks. And he noticed that we thought that they were short-sighted or long-sighted or something because it was affecting their reading. But he wasn't prepared to take that. He said, no, I think there's something more. And he found us or referred us on for more tests. And it showed that they had a problem. But as I say, one is not so serious and is solved with a special contact lens and glasses, and the other has been more so. But it is, I think there is the Keratoconus Society is quite supportive and has a lot of information for them.
And they are available on www.keratoconus-group.org.uk. And the spelling is keratoconus-group.org.uk. Now, do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
We used to listen to a lot of audiobooks when the children were young. They were great for long journeys. And I still listen to them if I'm doing, I'm on a long journey on my own, or sometimes if I'm doing the ironing, it's good. I cannot iron without some form of distraction, I must admit. And I think talking books, I like it when they're full and unabridged. You know, so you get the full, you get the writer's voice coming through.
Have you ever read any of your own works abridged?
I remember in the early days, one or two of my books were used by Women's Weekly into a small pocket novel, and they abridged those. I like to hear what the writer intended. So I tend to like reading or listening to a full story.
I always wonder what authors think of abridgments, because someone else is taking out something you wrote, which could hurt.
It does. I mean, it's like it's like somebody defacing one of your babies. It's you spend so long working on a book, but then on the other hand, if it's edited, very often we write long. You write a lot more words than the publisher wants, so you have to cut it back. And very often that's a good thing with a book. We tend to be, we can go over the same ground more than once. So you do have to go back over. It is a good idea to go back over and trim it and cut out excess paragraphs and repetition. But with an abridgment, it can be done, and it can be done well, I think. But you're bound to lose something that the writer thought was important enough to keep in the first place.
Thanks to Robert and to Sarah Mallory. A full list of her books is available from the RNIB Library, including Beneath the Major's Scars, which is TB20286. This week's Educating Read is one of those books we're all supposed to have read, even more so since 1999's hugely successful film version, starring Julianne Moore and Ralph Fiennes. It's The End of the Affair by Graham Greene.
A story has no beginning or end. Arbitrarily, one chooses that moment of experience from which to look back, or from which to look ahead. I say, one chooses, with the inaccurate pride of a professional writer who, when he has been seriously noted at all, has been praised for his technical ability. But do I in fact of my own will choose that black, wet January night on the Common in 1946? The sight of Henry Miles slanting across the wide river of rain? Or did these images choose me? It is convenient, it is correct according to the rules of my craft, to begin just there. But if I had believed then in a god, I could also have believed in a hand plucking at my elbow, a suggestion. Speak to him. He hasn't seen you yet. For why should I have spoken to him? If hate is not too large a term to use in relation to any human being, I hated Henry. I hated his wife Sarah too. And he, I suppose, came soon after the events of that evening to hate me, as he surely at times must have hated his wife, and that other, in whom in those days we were lucky enough not to believe. So this is a record of hate, far more than of love. And if I come to say anything in favour of Henry and Sarah, I can be trusted. I'm writing against the bias, because it is my professional pride to prefer the near truth, even to the expression of my near hate.
Set in London during the Second World War, it tells the story of a love triangle between Maurice Bendrix, Sarah Miles, and her husband Henry. Henry, a rather chinless and impotent civil servant, befriends Bendrix and introduces him to his wife Sarah. Their attraction is immediate, and Bendrix, a cynical, jealous writer struggling with the plot of his next novel, takes out his frustration on Henry by stealing his wife. As the blitz intensifies, Sarah and Bendrix continue their affair against a backdrop of falling bombs. But a greater threat to their happiness comes in the form of Bendrix's possessive jealousy. He's tormented by Sarah's refusal to divorce Henry, and now blames her for his writer's block. After a bomb destroys his flat, nearly killing him and Sarah, she breaks off the affair with no apparent explanation. Convinced she's seeing someone else, Bendrix hires a private detective to discover who it is. In this way, he obtains her diary and discovers a truth more profound than he expected. It's an intense, emotional story, told both from Bendrix's point of view and in extracts from Sarah's diary, that we too are stealing a glimpse at Sarah's most private thoughts only increases the sense of Bendrix's grubby selfishness. How much sympathy the reader has with him and with the couple's doomed affair probably comes down to a matter of personal morality. But the ever-present threat of death does provide a reason for Bendrix and Sarah's desire to live in the moment. Green's writing is powerfully evocative of those terrible and exhilarating times. His own house in Clapham, where the story mainly takes place, was bombed during the Blitz. Indeed, much of the material for the book is autobiographical. Sarah is based on his married lover of the time, Catherine Woolston, a fact that he made little secret of by dedicating the book to her when it was published in 1951. While it's common practice for authors to write what they know, I have to confess that I find Green's forensic examination of a love affair so close to his own personal experience rather too voyeuristic. Moreover, I've always been turned off by books that feature the writer's own struggle to write. To me, it seems a bit self-indulgent and unimaginative. That said, no one can fault Green on his brilliant prose, acerbic observations and lifelike characters.
While Henry fetched the drinks, I went into the lavatory. The walls were scrawled with phrases. Damn you, landlord, and your breasty wife. To all pimps and whores, a merry syphilis and a happy gonorrhea. I went quickly out again to the cheery paper streamers and the clink of glass. Sometimes I see myself reflected too closely in other men for comfort. And then I have an enormous wish to believe in the saints, in heroic virtue. I repeated to Henry the two lines I had seen. I wanted to shock him, and it surprised me when he said simply, "Jealousy's an awful thing." "Oh, you mean the bit about the breasty wife?" "Both of them. When you're miserable, you envy other people's happiness." It wasn't what I'd ever expected him to learn in the Ministry of Home Security. And there, in the phrase, the bitterness leaks again out of my pen. What a dull, lifeless quality this bitterness is. If I could, I would write with love. But if I could write with love, I would be another man. I would never have lost love. Yet suddenly across the shiny tiled surface of the bar table, I felt something, nothing so extreme as love, perhaps nothing more than a companionship in misfortune. I said to Henry, "Are you miserable?" "Bendrix, I'm worried." "Well, tell me." I expect it was the rum that made him speak, or was he partly aware of how much I knew about him? Sarah was loyal, but in a relationship such as ours had been, you can't help picking up a thing or two. I knew he had a mole on the left of his navel, because a birthmark of my own had once reminded Sarah of it.
No one writes more beautifully about flawed characters than Graham Greene. His ability to put them under the microscope at moments of extreme emotions is at times breathtaking. Their hopes, fears and beliefs are all examined, but seldom judged. He leaves that to the reader. In the end of the affair, Bendrix, and by extension Green, is desperate to find meaning in the futility of war-torn Europe, craving comfort in the darkest hours. It was the last of four novels in which Green openly explored his doubts about his Catholic faith. As such, it's both a spiritual and a conventional love story. Much of the discomfort the reader might feel comes as a result of Bendrix's self-torment. He's a man looking for a miracle amid the ruins of all he once believed in. Many will argue that the emergence of the end of the affair from the ashes of the Blitz is precisely that miracle. It's exquisitely crafted, hauntingly memorable, and emotionally intense. A little too intense and crafted for my tastes, but still well worth reading, especially if you enjoy books about the home front during the Second World War. The version I downloaded from Overdrive was beautifully read by Patrick Romer and Joan Walker and is available from the RNIB Library as TB14055. And in case any further proof were needed for the quality of Green's writing, a commercially available version of the novel, read by Colin Firth, was Audiobook of the Year on its release in 2012. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd love to share. Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now, as promised, it's back to Francesca Siegel to hear the books of her life. So, Francesca, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell me if there was a book that you read as a child or a youth that made you want to become an author?
I don't know if this is the book that made me want to become an author, but going really sort of back to the first books I was reading, I've just recently sought out and rediscovered a book called The Paper Bag Princess by Robert Munch, which I just think is sort of a work of genius. I've got 18-month-old twin daughters, and almost the first thing I did after the US election was go scavenging in my mother's basement to try and find my copy of The Paper Bag Princess. I would have always wanted them to read it, but it suddenly felt urgent that they read a children's book in which a princess loses all her clothes in a fire, battles a dragon, sets off bravely dressed in nothing but a paper bag, and then when the prince rejects her for being too grubby, calls him a bum and skips off happily by herself into the sunset. And I think I never forgot reading it. It was so different from so many of the other fairy stories that were around. And I think it's really important that, and of course now more and more children's books have pluckier heroines and it's not just princesses waiting around to be rescued, but that book made a massive impact on me and I think is really important and funny and sweet and beautiful.
Unfortunately, this book isn't in the RNIB Talking Books library, but if you head online, you can hear it read by the author.
This is The Paper Bag Princess, told by Robert Munch. There was a princess named Elizabeth who was going to marry a prince named Ronald. Unfortunately, a large dragon flew up. It took an enormous fiery breath. Breathed out so much fire, it burned up all of Elizabeth's castle, burned up all of Elizabeth's clothes, and carried off Prince Ronald for dinner. Elizabeth wanted to chase that dragon, but she didn't have any clothes. The only thing she could find that wasn't burnt was a paper bag. She put it over her head, went off after the dragon. She came to a big cave. Cave had a big door. Elizabeth knocked on it. She went bong, 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 bong. The dragon opened up the door. It said, "Go away. I have already eaten one first grade, two second grades, three third grades, and a daycare center. Come back. I will eat you tomorrow."
And is there a book that you would like to curl up on a rainy day with and reread on the sofa, given nothing else to do?
I think my rainy day, as soon as you said curl up and rainy day, it's hard to look past Brideshead Revisited. I think I was almost going to say Midnight's Children, which is possibly my all-time favourite book, but there's something about the curling up on the sofa. I don't think you can beat Evelyn Waugh. It's just so evocative and sumptuous and funny and acerbic and insightful and just wonderful. And that audiobook read by Jeremy Irons is just, I would listen to Jeremy Irons recite the ingredients of my breakfast cereal. That voice.
Towards the end of that summer term, I received the last visit and grand remonstrance of my cousin Jasper. I was just free of the schools, having taken the last paper of history previous on the afternoon before. Jasper's subfusc suit and white tie proclaimed him still in the thick of it. He had, too, the exhausted but resentful air of one who fears he has failed to do himself full justice on the subject of Pindar's orphism. Duty alone had brought him to my rooms that afternoon, at great inconvenience to himself and, as it happened, to me, who, when he caught me in the door, was on my way to make final arrangements about a dinner I was giving that evening. It was one of several parties designed to comfort Hardcastle, one of the tasks that had lately fallen to Sebastian and me, since, by leaving his car out, we had got him into grave trouble with the proctors. Jasper would not sit down. This was to be no cosy chat. He stood with his back to the fireplace and, in his own phrase, talked to me like an uncle.
And is there something that you've read or listened to recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
The most recent contemporary... Actually, a lot of the audiobooks I listen to tend to be sort of classic novels or going back further, but a contemporary book I just listened to was The New Maggie O'Farrell, This Must Be the Place, and I really enjoyed that book. And that was my first experience of not a LibriVox book, but one that did actually switch between voices. They had a man's voice and a woman's voice doing the different, narrating the different chapters, which I thought was really interesting. But I thought that book was great, and she managed to take what could have been in other hands a really improbable plot and actually make it compelling and convincing, and time passed almost without me noticing it, and actually had a very complex structure that was beautifully handled.
It was almost the 1990s. The very start of the final decade of the millennium, and we had just arrived in London. We had not long ago left university. Just months previously, we had been holding the whole of critical theory in our heads. We had crammed all night to memorise the dates of European wars, the fluctuations in meaning of the imperfective aspect in Russian. We had entered exam halls, turned over the papers set down on the desks, taken up our pens, and known that these were the last exams we would ever sit. The things we knew.
Well, thank you, Francesca Segal, for coming in and sharing the books of your life and your love of reading with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
My thanks again to Francesca. And if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address? readonair@rnib.org.uk. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and all of you who've been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and ideas for books that I should read. Next week, we'll be revealing the results of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch about anything that you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.